Podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology with an MFT evening format. Priority deadline to apply for September classes is August 5th. gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Home Broadcast Center, this is Take Two, me Martinez. In a few years, if you buy a new car in California, it will be required to average over 50 miles per gallon. Find out which car companies have pledged to make that happen. Plus, guacamole without avocado. I know, doesn't make any sense, but it is a thing happening at taquerias all over LA. Don't worry, we got your back. We're bringing in an expert to help you spot the fake guac. It's ahead on Take Two.
This is Larry Mantle. Join me for our next Film Week screening, Boogie Nights, 1970s LA's porn industry in transition. Saturday night, July 27th at the Theater at Ace Hotel. Tickets at kpcc.org/in-person.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. Me, Martinez, creeping up on August, and it was raining outside as I was driving in. It has been a weird weather summer for us here in LA. All right, coming up on today's show, the latest wranglings over the Egyptian Theater. Will Netflix be able to buy it or not? We've got the details coming up in about 20 minutes. Plus, tacos. We're going to tag along with taco scout Javier Cabral and bring him into the studio to sample some guacamole. It turns out some of what we get from taco shops just isn't the real deal. But first, California struck a deal with four of the world's largest automakers today. BMW, Ford, Honda, and Volkswagen joined forces with the state's Air Resources Board on new vehicle pollution standards. Under the new plan, passenger vehicles by these automakers would achieve an average of 51 miles per gallon by 2026. Now, that's slightly less than the fuel economy they were supposed to get on a faster timeline under rules put in place when Barack Obama was president. Thing is, though, it comes weeks before the Trump administration aimed to give them a break. Those plans would have let automakers create vehicles that produce more tailpipe pollution. So why would car makers side with California's rules instead of the federal government's? Well, to answer that, we've got Mary Nichols. She's chair of the California Air Resources Board. Mary, welcome back to Take Two.
Thank you.
All right. Now, this deal doesn't affect all automakers, just four of them, BMW, Ford, Honda, and Volkswagen. Why those car companies, and what have they agreed to do exactly?
So these four manufacturers, who represent about 30% of the overall car market nationally, approached us and said they would like to sit down and see if we could hammer out what would look like a good deal from a national perspective. And their intention is not to be exclusive. They would welcome other companies signing on, and so would we. And I expect that they will be signing on now that this is out there. But although the industry has been willing to be quite vociferous about not wanting to go as far as the Trump administration has been proposing to go in rolling back the standards that were agreed to under President Obama, they've also been afraid, frankly, of taking on the Trump administration for the simple reason that the administration has a lot of cards to play, and one of them is trade. And so with the willingness to put sanctions on parts or equipment that are imported from other countries, the manufacturers were, in many cases, frankly, just afraid to openly speak up.
Yeah, but what would this allow these companies to do, this deal with California?
Well, if this deal were to be adopted as a national program, what it would do would be to give them an additional year before they would have to meet the tailpipe standards that were called for under the 2012 agreement. So they get a little more time to stretch out their compliance. And in return for that, they would also get some credits, potentially for introducing more electric vehicles, selling more electric vehicles, putting on some equipment that's now been demonstrated that can reduce emissions by making the cars more streamlined or making their...
So this could get the wheels rolling, so to speak, on maybe a national program at some point.
Yes, so that was really the idea, was to demonstrate that there could be a national program that would achieve essentially the same results as the old plan, but give the companies more flexibility. And so that's really the point, is that by sitting down and working out this agreement with these four companies, we have come up with a model that shows that what the Trump administration is asking for is unnecessary and not good either for the industry or for the environment.
Talking to Mary Nichols, chair of the California Air Resources Board. Now, it's expected that part of the Trump administration's proposal for rolled back passenger vehicle emission rules would also rescind California's right to set its own emission standards. And California has been able to do so for decades as part of the Federal Clean Air Act. Can you explain why that's the case, Mary?
Well, it's a matter of ideology with these folks, that they don't think California should have a role in setting emission standards for ourselves or for the other states that want to follow our rules. And actually, it's even a little bit worse than that, because the leading ideologues in the Trump administration don't believe that EPA ought to be involved either. In other words, they don't believe that there should be any program to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. They think that anything that affects fuel economy ought to come under the Department of Transportation as part of the CAFE rules. The CAFE rules were adopted a number of years ago in an attempt to deal with imports of petroleum during the energy crisis, but they've pretty much outlived their usefulness at this point. However, they don't have anything to do with the issue of global warming or air pollution, and that's what the administration hates about our program.
But Mary, what if the Trump administration moves forward with weakening the vehicle emission standards? I mean, will you sue? Will California sue?
Absolutely. Okay. We've indicated up until now that we will litigate. We're prepared to do that. Our attorney general is ready, and he's got a bunch of other attorneys general now. There's at least 15 of them that are suing. We're already in court over the preliminary round of this, which is back in the day when Scott Pruitt overturned the Obama technical report that underlies all of these standards. So,
is that why you think maybe these four automakers decided to side with you, because maybe they foresaw how it could play out eventually?
Well, you know, I think I'm betting on us when it comes to a legal battle, because we have a good track record there, and we think that the statute is pretty clear that we have a right to do what we're doing. But I think it's more to the point that they realize that what we want to do and the direction that we're pushing them to go, even though they wanted a little more time or a little more flexibility, is where they want to go too. They want to keep making improvements in fuel economy year over year. They want to be building more zero emission vehicles, because that's where their market is worldwide. So what the Trump administration now is proposing to do is really radical, but it's based on the idea that they just want to get rid of all regulations. And the industry, by what they're doing here, by coming to California, is saying, look, we don't mind dealing with California. We think California actually has a pretty rational approach to what they're trying to do, and we want to work with them.
Mary Nichols, chair of the California Air Resources Board. Mary, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, it should come as a surprise to no one that Democrats are the largest group of registered voters in California. But who holds spot number two? If you thought it was Republicans, you would be wrong. That designation actually goes to no party preference voters, or NPPs. There are about 1 million more of them than Republicans, and their ranks have increased more than 20% since October of 2016. And all that matters a lot right around primary season. That's because the candidates you're allowed to vote for are determined by your affiliation. Those rules are set by the Democratic and Republican parties. It's this arrangement that has a cohort of independent voters and candidates feeling a bit burned. They filed a suit Tuesday against California's election administrator, Secretary of State Alex Padilla, alleging a violation of their constitutional rights. Ben Christopher wrote about this for Cal Matters. Ben joins us now. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Okay, before we get into the whos and the whats, let's try to understand this a little bit better. Primaries are tricky for both independent presidential candidates and independent voters. So let's start off with an example. Let's say I'm a no-party preference voter, an independent, but I want to vote for an independent candidate. What do I see on my ballot?
So it depends. And again, we are just talking about the presidential primary. If we're looking at other primaries, just to make it even more complicated, it's a whole other system. Yeah. But for the presidential primary, we're looking at 2020. So if you want to vote for a Republican, your options are pretty limited. You have to register as a Republican and then vote in their primary. That's it. There's no workaround there. If you wanted to vote for a Democrat, you could either register as a Democrat or you could request a ballot ahead of time if you're voting by mail, or if you show up at the polls, just ask for that Democratic ballot. But there is an additional step that you have to hop through. But if you want to vote for an independent candidate, you're out of luck because independent candidates can't participate in the presidential primary in California.
So I'm in a bind then, I guess, right? Unless I know all of these things in advance, I might not see much on my ballot.
Well, that's right. If you're voting in person, you can just ask for the ballot that you want when you show up. But if you're voting by mail, which over half of Californians do at this point, you have to do it about a week in advance. And so that has in the past left some political independents, NPP voters, in the lurch. There was a poll after the 2016 election in which about 40% of NPP voters said that they wanted to participate in the Democratic primary and weren't able to do so.
All right. So let's use one more scenario for this for a second. If I were me myself, an independent presidential candidate, and I wanted to show up on a ballot in California, why would that be difficult for me?
Well, for the presidential primary, bad news, you can't participate. The original purpose of the primary is for parties to choose who will represent them in a general election. So if you're not part of a party, if you're an independent, it just doesn't apply to you. This kind of gets at this broader question of what is a primary for? And again, the presidential primary system is based on the system of parties sitting down and figuring out who they want to put on the general election ballot. And so if you're an independent, that just doesn't apply to you. But there is, of course, another way of looking at primaries, which is that in practice, they serve this broader social political function of kind of the first round general election. And so in that context, maybe it does look unfair. And that's sort of what brings us to this lawsuit.
So let's get into that. That was filed this week. Who are the people behind the suit? And what do they say about changing this current system?
So the group is called the Independent Voter Project, which is a nonprofit in California made up of independent voters, no surprise. So they make a few legal arguments here about why the current presidential primary system in California is unconstitutional. First, they say that the California Constitution requires the state to hold an open primary. That's the term that is in the California Constitution. That term is never actually explicitly defined. What does an open primary mean? But their case is that basically that should mean people can vote for whomever they want without restrictions or conditions. So if you're an NPP voter and you want to vote for, say, Bernie Sanders, or you want to vote for Donald Trump, you should be able to do that without having to affiliate yourself with either the Democratic or the Republican Party. And that brings us to another argument that they make, which is about the U.S. Constitution. So the First Amendment guarantees the right to free speech, freedom of religion, but also freedom of association, which means the state can't force you to belong to a particular party or a particular civic group or not to. And so, again, the plaintiffs here are arguing that by creating the system where someone has to go and join the Republican Party, for example, to vote for a particular candidate, that's a violation of that person's freedom of association.
Talking to Ben Christopher, political reporter for Cal Matters. Now, you reached out to Alex Padilla's office. They had no comment. And it's worth saying that this is the first time this kind of argument has been presented in a California court, but federal judges have actually weighed in on this before. What have they said?
Well, they've weighed in on a similar argument. So in the past, there have been legal challenges in which plaintiffs have said, look, these closed primary systems where you don't get to vote in the Democratic or the Republican primary, for example, unless you're a member of those parties, that's unconstitutional. And actually, the Supreme Court in 2000 had said, no, actually, parties can basically hold closed primaries if they want. It's up to them. It's actually their right to association. But this is actually a slightly different argument. The plaintiffs here are saying, yeah, okay, parties can hold their own nominating contests however they like. If they want to have them closed, that's fine. The Supreme Court is pretty clear on that. But the state, which is using taxpayer dollars and holding this big public election, it has to provide some other option to all these NPP voters who want to have their voice heard. So their proposal is that the state provide a separate ballot, they call it a public ballot, for all of these political independents and let them vote for whoever they want. You'd have every candidate on that list and they could just have their voice heard that way. But as far as I know, it's an untested legal question.
You know, from a legal perspective, does Alex Padilla, the Secretary of State, does he have the power to give these independent voters what they want?
So that's the rub. I mean, the plaintiffs are certainly arguing that he can and that he should, and that the Constitution, both the state and the federal Constitution, require him to. It's worth pointing out that there's another sticking point, which is that the national parties have certain rules about how primaries should be held. So there's the possibility that, let's say, Alex Padilla's office could go ahead and do this. There's a possibility that if California starts changing up the system, the parties would decide not to count the state's votes because it's not in compliance with their rules. And I don't know how likely that is, but it's possible that Padilla's office might be a little reluctant to take that risk without clear direction from the state legislature or from voters.
It's Ben Christopher, political reporter for Cal Matters. Ben, thanks a lot.
Hey, thanks a lot.
All right, streaming services dominate all of the screens in our lives. Just think about what you watch on your phone, tablet, laptop, TV. Good chance it's probably from Netflix, Amazon, or Hulu. Well, now one of those wants to buy a really big and iconic screen right on Hollywood Boulevard. Find out the who and why when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. All right, now to a local landmark. Hollywood Boulevard is lined with glamorous theaters from the golden age of film, including The Egyptian. The Pharaoh-themed theater screens rare, independent, and classic movies and is currently owned and operated by the nonprofit America Cinematheque, but not for long. Last April, Netflix started making moves to buy the historic theater, except just like any great drama, there are some twists and turns that are making that difficult. Matthew Blake has been following this controversial acquisition for the LA Business Journal. He joins us now. Matthew, welcome to Take Two.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so why would Netflix want to own a theater when they pretty much dominate every single other screen out there in the world?
Right. So the reason that they want to own a theater, there's a pretty simple explanation, which is that currently, in order to be nominated for an Oscar, you need to have your film exhibit in a brick-and-mortar movie theater for a short period of time before the Academy can even consider you. And Netflix, as you know, has been moving increasingly toward original programming. They want to consider themselves as serious as a filmmaker as any of the legacy studios. And in order to do that, you need to make films that get considered by the Oscars. And so that's kind of the foremost reason why Netflix would want to do this. Also, they're really expanding their presence in Hollywood. They have a huge studio now on Sunset Boulevard. They increasingly want to see themselves as kind of a player in the Hollywood ecosystem. They're part of the Motion Picture Association of America right now. So it's really part of their bid to sort of say we're as much a part of, you know, the modern movie age as, you know, Disney or Paramount.
What's the cultural and historical significance of the Egyptian theater? I mean, I remember 1981, Matthew, I got to see Raiders of the Lost Ark at the Egyptian. So considering that half or most of the movie is set in Egypt, to walk through the Egyptian and to watch Raiders of the Lost Ark was a pretty cool moment.
Yeah, so the Egyptian was built in the early 1920s. You know, it was right after the King Tut tomb was discovered, and so there was kind of a rage for all things Egyptian throughout the Western world at that time. And so Sid Grauman, a big showman of the 1920s, he kind of engineered the Egyptian. It had the very first LA movie premiere, so it's, you know, has historic significance in that respect. The 1922 version of Robin Hood, starring Douglas Fairbanks, Robin Hood. And, you know, throughout the years, it's kind of been this grand, iconic marvel of sort of Hollywood's glory. You mentioned seeing Raiders of the Lost Ark there. When I was doing my reporting for this, I learned that for two straight years in the late 1950s, they showed nothing other than Ben-Hur on their movie screens. So it's really sort of like this, you know, jewel of, you know, when people like to romanticize about Hollywood and think about sort of the glory days of show business, it's there. And I think that's a big part of, you know, why the city wanted to revive it in the 90s.
Now, we're talking to Matthew Blake from the LA Business Journal. Now, you mentioned the 90s. That's when America Cinematheque bought the theater from the city for $1. What kind of steward has American Cinematheque been?
Right. Well, I mean, in a sense, they've, you know, been a competent steward in the fact that they had this mandate, you know, we're going to give this to you for $1. We're going to give you millions of dollars more to, like, rebuild it. And they've done that, and they're showing movies, and they're showing screenings. Uh-huh. But, you know, operationally, they're very, you know, by some metrics, a poorly run nonprofit. They... you know, if you're a nonprofit, there's various state and federal auditing requirements, and basically they failed to meet these requirements.
Oh.
The state attorney general has written them numerous letters the last few years saying, where are your financial audits? There have been instances where the American Cinematheque has come back and said, well, we've had, you know, people have been sick or out for a long time.
No good.
Sort of like the dog ate my homework type excuses.
Geez.
And so they're actually under delinquent status right now.
So their track record's not very good, then it sounds like.
Yeah, the track record's not very good, though American Cinematheque does claim that it's not that bad and they can still turn around matters and be a good steward.
But now Netflix wants to buy it. Not so simple, though, because studios cannot own movie theaters. Remind us really quick of those legalities.
Yeah, so that's kind of complicated. So there is this big Supreme Court decision way back in 1949, U.S. v. Paramount Pictures, and that basically said that it violates antitrust laws if studios have big shares in movie theaters. So all the big studios at the time, including Paramount, of course, needed to divest from movie theaters. What's unclear in 2019 is whether, you know, literally all, you know, filmmakers, which now Netflix would be a part of, would be prevented from buying a brick-and-mortar theater. The Trump administration actually last year said that they were going to revisit the consent decree that came from that Supreme Court case. And additionally, the Trump administration actually scolded the Oscars earlier this year for, you know, its requirement that all movies be played at theaters before they can be nominated for an Oscar. So it sounds like Netflix may legally be able to do this.
Oh, okay.
I would certainly suspect, as I think you're alluding to, you know, some type of legal challenges.
Hey, Matthew, really quick before we go, so where does the city stand on this?
Yeah, we don't know where the city stands on this. So the city, they gave this land to American Cinematheque, and I tried to speak with the city council member there. Mitch O'Farrell spoke with the city attorney there. And they're not sure. They're not sure if there's restrictions in terms of American Cinematheque selling the land to a for-profit, selling the land to Netflix. The city really hasn't taken a position either way as to whether they will let this go through.
All right. We'll keep an eye on it. Matthew Blake with the LA Business Journal. Matthew, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, moving on. 1 million people in California struggle with access to clean drinking water. In places like the Central Valley, in the heart of California's agriculture industry, the state has a grant program that provides bottled water to 51 communities. So yesterday, Governor Newsom signed a bill that will provide $130 million of cap-and-trade funds to clean up drinking water. But a lot of environmental advocates are disappointed with this decision, not because clean water isn't important to them, but because this money was supposed to be used for cleaning up California's air. For more, we have Adam Beam from the Associated Press. Adam, welcome to Take Two.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Adam, remind us how cap-and-trade dollars were intended to be used when the program was put in place.
Well, most of the money goes to something called the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund. And by the name of that fund, you can tell what it's supposed to do, which is to reduce greenhouse gases. You know, as an example, a lot of the money goes toward the state's agricultural industry to do things like upgrade their diesel engines and to reduce methane pollution.
All right, so then if greenhouse gas reduction is the name of the fund, how does this new law for clean water fit into cap-and-trade goals?
Well, they needed a place to get the money from. They didn't want to take the money from the general fund because if you do that, it's really easy to just take it away. You know, it could be used for a multitude of purposes. So they were trying to find something that would be harder for lawmakers to change their minds later. So they looked at the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, and they had to make a justification for it. And their justification is, well, while they do know that a lot of the problems with the drinking water is caused from pollution from the big farms in the area, it's also true that a lot of the contamination comes from natural causes like arsenic and things. And they believe that that is caused primarily by climate change, the impact of climate change, including greenhouse gas emissions. So they feel like there's a connection there. Because, for example, you know, the climate change has caused increased droughts, which has depleted groundwater basins. So they feel like that it's an appropriate use of the money for that reason.
So that's the justification on that. And why are some environmental advocates disappointed with the decision to pass this law?
It's not that they don't, but they oppose cleaning up drinking water. But this money is specifically set aside to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, to clean up the state's air. And they feel that by opening the door for using this money for some other purpose, that next year you're going to see just a ton of other interests come in and say, well, you know, we're affected by climate change too. We need some of that money. And they're afraid it's just going to continue to dilute the fund to the point that it won't be satisfying its original goals.
Is there some sense that it's almost like you're pitting water versus air?
Yeah, State Senator Bob Wachowski from the Bay Area, that's been his primary argument. He says, you know, these are two very important critical issues, and it's not fair to make them, you know, fight against one another for funding.
So what's this law going to look like in practice?
It's still kind of unclear. You know, the state has a lot of money available to help these water districts with their infrastructure, you know, put in the pipes, building water treatment plants. Most recently in 2014, the voters approved a nearly $8 billion bond to do those types of things. But the state does not have a way to help districts operate. So that's what the goal of this money is, to identify water systems that are failing and to help them to operate, to give them some money to help them, you know, keep the equipment running. And we don't really know how that's going to work yet. The State Water Resources Control Board has to come up with a plan over the next year. And part of that plan is identifying which water districts need this money and then, you know, starting a process to try to give them some.
Well, now that that money is flowing in that direction, so to speak, I mean, how badly is it needed in these areas?
Yeah, it's pretty bad. I mean, there's the number that is generally accepted is at least 1 million people out of nearly 40 million in California don't have access to clean drinking water. A smaller group of those people, it's super serious. If they drink it literally, it would make them sick and possibly kill them right then. So those are the people that have to, you know, seek out these grant programs that provide them bottled water from the state. Others, they just have dirty drinking water, and it's either contaminated with known carcinogens. And for those people, the options are a lot less limited. They could try to buy bottled water themselves, which can be expensive, and this is kind of a rural area with a lot of poor people that can't do that. I was talking to an advocate yesterday who told me that one of the main ways that people get water there is a lot of grocery stores will have water vending machines out front, and these are basically just a garden hose that's run through a filter. You pay 50 cents a gallon. You bring your own container, and you can fill up, you know, for 50 cents a gallon. A lot of people do that.
That's state government reporter Adam Beam with the Associated Press. Adam, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right. I'm going to say something right now that is probably going to be offensive to most people. I'll just say it. Guacamole without avocado. I know, doesn't make sense. But it is a thing happening at taquerias all over L.A. Don't worry, though. We got your back. We're bringing in an expert to help you spot the fake guac. That's coming up when Take Two continues.
Podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth, an online hybrid tailored for working professionals with attendance only twice per term in West LA. Attend an info session to learn more. Classes start September 3rd. Apply by August 5th for up to $8,000 in scholarships at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. Javier Cabral just might have one of the best gigs on the planet. Besides being the editor of LA Taco, he was the Taco Scout and associate producer of the new Spanish-language Netflix series, The Taco Chronicles. That means you get to spend most of last year traveling to Mexico, sometimes eating as many as 10 tacos a day to find the tastiest carnitas, asada, barbacoa, canasta, guisado, and pastor, lucky duck. He also found some tasty tacos at Sonora Town and Gorilla Tacos in downtown LA, the only restaurants outside of Mexico featured on the show. Now, we visited these spots with Javier to find out what it takes to be a taco scout.
The qualities that it takes to be a taco scout, one, you have to have a gut of steel. Two, you have to have a hyper-crazy metabolism. And the last thing is just be persistent, because as Jonathan Gold, you know, who's my mentor, one of the first things that he told me was, for every good meal, you will have 10 bad ones. And even in Mexico, you know, there are a lot of great tacos, but there are a lot of bad tacos. My name is Javier Cabral, and I am the associate producer and taco scout for The Taco Chronicles, which is airing now on Netflix. We have no talking heads. We have no hosts. The only people who are talking are the tacos themselves.
Soy el taco que nunca te deja solo. Soy tu taco para siempre.
It flips the concept of a food show on its tortilla. We have personified tacos. It's a taco that is reflecting in its history and a taco looking out into its future and evolution. We are at the corner of Maple and 8th Street in downtown LA on the Fashion District. And it is our lucky day because A, we found free street parking in the shade. And B, we're about to go eat the best carne asada in LA at this place that is featured on The Taco Chronicles called Sonora Town.
Hi, my name is Jennifer Feltham, and I'm one of the owners of Sonora Town Taqueria in downtown LA. My boyfriend is the second owner of the shop, and his name is Teodoro Diaz Rodriguez. We do food in the style of our family taqueria in Sonora, Mexico. It's called Asadero Campas. It's in San Luis Rio Colorado. Basically, we do flour tortillas instead of corn. We specialize in them because that's what's popular in northern Mexico. So we drive to Sonora twice per month to bring over as many sacks of flour as we can manage. We cook over mesquite wood flame because mesquite is prevalent in the Sonoran Desert and meat is king in Sonora, steak. So we really pride ourselves in using a fine quality of cut of beef for our carne asada. We use short rib or costilla.
Here's three tacos de asada.
I would like to point out the elements of a proper carne asada plate. Green onions that are charred, limes are given, radishes sliced really thin. And then finally, the tacos. We just came from Sonora Town, and sometimes you have to have more than one taco stop. So we are in the Arts District, and we are at Gorilla Tacos, which is the second American taqueria that is featured in the Taco Chronicles.
My name is Wesley Avila. I'm the chef owner at Gorilla Tacos here in the Arts District in Los Angeles. We try to get the best ingredients we can possible to provide the best tacos. It started off as a cart and went to a truck, and now this is the manifestation of 7 years of work. My food is authentic to Los Angeles. When somebody says, you're not doing Mexican food, I was like, you're absolutely right, I'm not doing Mexican food. I feel like I'm authentic to the city, and I try to play true to the strengths of it being a melting pot, and my food reflects that.
So first we start off with sweet potatoes. These sweet potatoes have been cooked in basically salty water till they're soft. So we warm them up, get them a little caramelized, and get your tortilla warm. Probably be the sweet potatoes are like probably most recognizable taco. It's inspired by my tía Melinda that would cook for us. She'd make a bunch of potato tacos and leave them in the fridge for us. My mom passed away when I was 15, so she kind of helped out and like
here's food for you guys. And it's funny because like it'll be like a year since I've tasted one, and then I'll taste it and I'll be like, oh, that's why people order it so much.
We just finished our second and last taco stop. I'm feeling blissed out. That's the same feeling that I hope the show accomplishes. And I want people to take tacos seriously because tacos are an art and they're meant to evolve, as evident in these sweet potato taco that we had. So keep an open mind, support your local taquero, and remember, like, tacos will always be there for you.
You can find the Taco Chronicles on Netflix, and this piece was produced by Natalie Chudnovsky. All right, speaking of tacos, let's talk about the guacamole that goes on top of them, because there's a minor controversy about it. The guy you just heard from, Javier Cabral, wrote about this for LA Taco. He's in studio with me now. Hey, what's up?
What's up? How are you?
Good, good. All right, so I've got some of this wok in front of us with chips. So let's take a bite right off the top here. Just to establish our taste buds a little. It's okay. It's a little more runny and watery than I expected it to be when I dipped the chip in it. But okay, here we go.
I gotta say, all right, let's do it.
Yeah, it's not the chunky wok that's usually served. It's very, very thin. That's the best way I can describe it. It's green like wok, but it's thin. We got this from a place in the general KPCC area. What's the truth behind some taqueria guacamole?
Taqueria guacamole is a runnier, purposely watery, so you can spoon over your tacos, and it won't be a taco, it won't be a guacamole taco, but it'll be a taco de carne asada with a little bit of avocado flavor. And word broke in Mexico City of taquerias that were using Mexican summer squash instead of avocados for the base of this guacamole salsa. So the next morning, I took it upon myself to whip up a version of this poser guacamole.
Poser guacamole.
Of this imposter. And, I got to say, I got to admit that even with someone that has eaten over 1,000 tacos in the last year alone, it is scarily, scarily similar.
Yeah, okay. So what do we know about this recipe? You mentioned how you actually were able to put it together. Where did it come from, first off?
So this poser guacamole video came out on YouTube by this YouTuber. She's known for doing comfort foods that we love to eat in Mexico, but making home-cooked versions of it. And she called it a fake guacamole or a falso guacamole, a false guacamole.
Yeah.
So a taqueria guacamole traditionally is made from tomatillos, which are either simmered or roasted, some kind of chile, usually a jalapeño or a serrano, and cilantro, which adds, that herbaceous, refreshing kick. And then, you have your essential avocado. In this fake guacamole, you replace the avocado, the raw avocado, and you essentially poach or briefly cook the squash for about 5 minutes, just so it's tender enough to be able to be blended. And then what you do is you put all those ingredients in a blender without any of the water. The jalapeño chile, you fry it up and you throw that chile in the blender with the oil that you use to brown it. That oil, what it does is it emulsifies the salsa. So by texture and color, it's creamy green, like a light green, like an avocado. And the flavors, it tastes herbaceous and refreshing. It tastes spicy. It tastes tart. It's a little salty if you add enough salt. And it's pretty damn good. And the last ingredient that I forgot is a clove or two of raw garlic. Mm. The raw garlic adds that kind of tang addictiveness that we love. To be honest, it's pretty good.
We're talking to taco expert Javier Cabral. He writes for LA Taco about this fake wok that is all over the place in LA. Now, okay, so take me through the flavor profile for a second, just so I can kind of guide the listeners through it if they're about to go get lunch somewhere. Tell me what I should be tasting. Number one, I mean, right off, I don't think I should be pouring my wok, but I can pour it if I need to over whatever I'm going to eat. So that's right off the bat. So I'm going to take a bite, and right off the bat, what am I tasting?
So when I was writing this story, I wanted to make sure
this is not good. This is just not good.
So when I wrote the story, I wanted to make sure that, if I was putting this information out there, that I can back it up.
Yeah.
So what I was able to do by only doing a side-by-side taste comparison of the real avocado guacamole versus this calabacita guacamole, which is the Mexican zucchini summer squash, is that squash, by nature, if you think about it, has a sweeter flavor, a slightly sweeter flavor, right? Avocado is creamy and fatty. So if you taste your taqueria guacamole and if it's tasting a little bit sweet, that's one telltale sign. The second telltale sign is that
You know, guacamole, when you make it at home, what's the first thing that happens once it's been out for a while? It starts to turn black. It starts to oxidize. The zucchini guacamole also starts to oxidize, but not as quickly and as dark as an avocado.
Now, there are people in this world that will reject this out of hand. They don't even want to think about guac not being chunky, not being creamy. But for some people, Javier, this is a godsend.
This story has resonated with so many people. It's kind of crazy to say it's like around the world. And I've gotten some DMs, and they tell me that they haven't been able to eat guacamole since they were diagnosed with an avocado allergy, you know, which is what some people call a latex fruit allergy. So this recipe for them, they've made it, and they take photos, and they post about it, and they tag me, and they're like, I can finally enjoy guacamole again. Thank you so much. Another demographic that has reached out are all the moms with the picky eaters, you know, who their kids don't like to eat you know, vegetables and squash. You know, I was one of those kids when I was younger. So, you know, those moms are making this recipe too, probably amping up the squash in it. And now it's a way to feed their picky kids some vegetables.
That's Javier Cabral, the new editor for the news and culture website, LA Taco. Javier, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, I'm going to paint a picture of my retirement. I'm going to be walking on a beach, wee hours of the morning, wearing socks with my sandals because it's going to be chilly. I'm going to be scanning the sand with a metal detector. Got to pass the time somehow. Coming up next, we'll hear how one guy's metal detecting helps people rescue lost memories. That's next in 60 seconds. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. Now to a quirky, only in LA kind of story we first aired last year. One of our contributors, Bradley Bermont, was out surfing early one summer morning when he saw an older guy in a bucket hat, zinc on his nose, metal detecting on the beach. Bradley couldn't figure out what the guy was doing there. It's not like Blackbeard left anything behind in Los Angeles, so he went up to talk to him.
Well, I tried at least. By the time I got out of the water, the guy in the bucket hat was already gone. So I had to do a little digging. But eventually I found him, and we met up on Venice Beach.
I mean, let's put it this way. I find more pool tabs and bottle caps than I find anything else.
That's Steve Smith. He's a retired welder who started metal detecting 5 years ago. He's not looking for buried treasure to get rich. He's doing it to help people. That's how this whole hobby got started for him.
The first ring recovery I made, it was this young lady who had lost her engagement ring.
Who found Steve online, and he says she was just bawling, totally devastated. But then he found
her. And it was like I flipped a switch in her head. I mean, she went from total despair to instant joy. And I thought, I want to see a lot more of that.
Yep. Steve finds people's stuff for them, and he doesn't do it for money. He responds to his calls like a firefighter does with a 911 call.
I've been out 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3, 4, 5, 6 in the morning.
Because there are other people with metal detectors.
They call themselves pirates.
Who will keep your stuff.
Those are the guys that I'm trying to beat.
I wanted to see firsthand how all this worked, so I invited myself along.
This guy's never going to call me up.
The sun was already down when we met up. We were standing on Ocean Avenue above Santa Monica Beach. The Ferris wheel on the pier was lit up in the distance, and there were a lot of people on the bike path and beach below us. Steve started going through his trunk, pulling out gear, a backpack, a metal detector, and this big sifter. It's sort of like a metal grated scoop on a broomstick handle. We hustled down to the beach, which is when David, Steve's client, walked up to us.
How you doing, man? Hey, so what'd you lose?
My wedding ring.
Oh, does your wife know?
She's the one kind of responsible. This is the second time she's done it to me.
Oh.
Uh-oh.
David's wife, Maria, is there on the beach. She said they'd been digging, looking for the ring, but
Hello.
Came up short.
Hi.
Hi.
How's it going?
Well, it was my fault, so it's not going so great.
Oh, no.
He left his t-shirt with his phone and his ring wrapped in the t-shirt on top of the towel. So I got out of the water first and I moved his stuff. And then when he came out of the water, he said, like, do you have my ring? And I was like, what? Your ring?
Steve asked what kind of metal the ring was made of and got to work.
All right, coming through.
He threw on his headphones and started scanning the area with his metal detector. It took about a second before he was scooping and sifting the sand.
was a bottle cap.
He tried again.
Yep, I think we got it. I think. Let's see. Oh, shoot. Maybe not.
That's it.
Oh, there it is.
That's it.
Where'd it go?
Yep.
Here we go.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, buddy.
Woo! We're still going to be married. No second divorce is happening anytime soon, guys. Maybe by the third time.
It took all of 2 minutes to actually find the ring. For Steve, the benevolent guy with the metal detector, this was a night well spent.
I mean, I know I didn't save their marriage, but still, it means a lot to them. You know, I mean, that ring, that's the ring that she gave him, and we want to make sure that the story that began with that ring finishes with that ring.
The next day, he went out and found two rings for two separate couples. For Take Two, I'm Bradley Bermont.
That was good.
Yeah.
You did good.
Thank you. We got another search tomorrow. Check it out.
They say there's wreckage washing up all along the coast. No one seems to know.
Finally, today on Take Two, San Diego has attracted health seekers for generations, people lured by the sun and coastline. In the final installment of our series for the California Dream Collaboration, KPBS's Amitha Sharma looks at how that promise continues to shape the city.
The San Diego Tourism Authority leans in to San Diego's reputation as a place to feel good. In an ad, people play on the beach. They surf, kids frolic, they hit volleyballs. The promo, says communications director Candace Ely, taps into the fundamental appeal of San Diego. She calls it sun vibes.
They get this good vibe, this good healthy feeling when they're here. They feel like they're their best self when they're here.
35 million tourists come to San Diego each year. They spent more than $11 billion in 2018.
As they walk outside of the airport, they just say they feel a difference in the air.
This is Tourism Authority Chief Operating Officer Carrie Verbeck-Kapich.
They actually say it makes them feel better and different immediately upon coming into the city.
And in spite of rising housing costs, people keep coming. While Los Angeles County lost people last year, San Diego County added nearly 18,000 to its population in 2018.
I think its natural beauty is the main thing right away. And then I think everything is sort of surrounded by the sun and the weather and the coastline.
That's real estate agent Joe Farage at the beach in Del Mar. He says many home buyers he works with come for the promise of the San Diego lifestyle.
That is really appealing to people. And then when you come here and you experience it, you'll see people, you know, doing paddleboard yoga. You'll see people surfing.
You can tell he's made this pitch before.
You'll see people kayaking. There's so many things to do. Or you can just see them meditating. It really inspires people.
And the appeal has helped health resorts thrive in the region.
We're the first fitness spa in the world. We're the original one. And we have had all kinds of awards as the best in the world.
That's Deborah Zeke. She and her husband, Edmund, started Rancho La Puerta back in 1940 in nearby Tecate, Mexico. In the 1950s, they opened the Golden Door Spa in San Diego County. Both still operate today. Deborah credits the beauty, the sea, the climate, but there's something else she can't name.
I wish I knew. It just is. But the Indians, you know, who settled here, had quite a high degree of culture and had the sense to pick it. So, I mean, it's always been a place that people select.
In San Diego, I'm Amitha Sharma.
This story is part of our California Dream collaboration. It's the last part of a three-part series on how San Diego developed a reputation as a place where people go to feel good and get healthy. You can read, watch, and listen to the complete series at kpbs.org. All right, if you missed any part of the show, lucky for you, we have a place where you can hear it all. Just go to wherever you get your podcasts and look for the Take Two Show. You can also find us on Twitter. We're at Take Two. That's at Take Two. I'm there as well, at A Martinez LA. That's at A Martinez LA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.